Yeah, I'm 61. My hometown is actually, I'm a ranch boy from a small town southeast of Tucson, about 100 miles, and then came up to the University of Arizona and did all of my undergraduate, graduate, medical school, residency, chief residency right here in Tucson. So I'm a local guy, 61 years old. I guess I'm too old to leave now. And so I'm sort of encased here, and came out into private practice after my chief residency as an internist.
Okay.
And practiced for about 15 years as an internist, and always did a lot of hospital medicine because my office was right out the back door of the ICU. So
okay.
If there was an 85-year-old with constipation, I could run over and do the code in the ICU, and she'd still be constipated when I got back. It was one of the frustrating things of primary care. So when hospitalists came along, I sort of jumped on the bandwagon and started doing this back in around 96 and 97, and then full-time in 98, being a hospitalist, and joined IPC in 2000 and ended up in this managerial position just because they needed somebody to sort of run the Tucson region.
Okay.
When the guy sort of left and took another job, so I sort of got bumped up the ladder to do the administrative while still being clinically active. In fact, I told Adam Singer that if I didn't like it, I got to go back to clinical, and Adam says, yes, and if we don't like what you're doing, you're going back to clinical. And here it is 10 years later, 11 years, so I guess I haven't broke the bank yet. Some days you wonder.
And so you got about 50 full-time providers, 30 part-time, so you, about a staff or 80 to 90, give or take.
Yeah.
How many hospitals do you provide service for?
We cover two large private community hospitals here in town, where we're the dominant group in there with 145 and 195, 200 patients, respectively, in each of those. And then we have a group of docs who just do the long-term acute care rehab, freestanding LTACs in rehab hospitals. And then we most recently have gone into the skilled nursing facility group with two groups that joined us, and we have about 15 skilled nursing facility docs and nurse practitioners who are in the nursing homes in town. So we try and cover the full gauntlet from ICU to discharge to adult care homes or home care, where we have people seeing the patients.
Okay. And, your duties, I know you see patients and you do the administrative work. What's pretty much your split? It doesn't sound like it's a 50-50.
No, it's not. I'm 80% administrative at this point, at least, and actually in the last 6 months, I'm probably 90% administrative. But it's sort of, over the years, to me, it's been about 80-20 in terms of working some weekends, working nights, filling in for a guy who breaks his leg skiing until we can get the schedule rearranged type stuff. So.
Gotcha.
80-20 is probably the reasonable amount.
Okay. Well, then let's kind of move on to, how did you just happen to be in Tucson at this time? I've read the reports. You were, stopping to buy a gallon of milk. Is that really the full story there? Were you guys heading somewhere?
Well, the full story is that my journal entry is, I titled it, I Blame the Brussels Sprouts, which sounds a little facetious, but my wife and I had a nice walk that morning, and we went to breakfast, and we went to McDonald's, and I had the oatmeal. I was so proud of myself without the double Whopper or Egg McMuffin with cheese and bacon or whatever. And then, as wives are wont to do, she pushes the envelope and says, I want to stop by and get Brussels sprouts. I haven't had them in 20 years. And my thought was, I haven't had them in 45 years since my mom stuck up the house with them. So we ended up at the Safeway, because the thing that keeps a marriage together is just those two key words, yes, dear. And so we ended up at Safeway that morning on the way back to our house. Walked by Gabrielle Giffords and her crew standing right outside the door. My wife commented, I'm glad we're not political. We don't have to stand in line and talk to Gabby. I said, yeah, I voted for her, so that's good enough for me. And went into the store and went right to the produce aisle and had been in the store not more than 3 to 4 minutes max, still in the produce aisle, and I heard the gunshots, which, of course, were right out the main door. The produce aisle's right by the main door. And that's how it started. I said to my wife, "Let's go, Nancy," and she didn't hear me. I thought she was right behind me. She had gone over to the Brussels sprouts. I was still in mushrooms. And so I did not run. I walked as quick as I could to the front door. And sort of woman rushed in saying they shot her. They shot Congresswoman Giffords. And so I stepped out and stood behind a pillar and no more gunshots. They had actually already taken down the shooter as soon as he ran out of bullets. And looked around the corner just to the carnage as you would expect. Everybody just mowed down. With Congresswoman Giffords, the first person that I saw who was right up at the head of the line near the front door. And the young man who helped her had already crawled over to her, and I, quite frankly, stepped over people who were no longer with us to get to her. Got her turned around and off of the window where she wasn't breathing real well. Worked on her airway, cleaning her airway with the young man who then held her for the next 15 to 20 minutes till the paramedics got her shipped up and ready to go to the hospital. And then from there, my role was one of field triage, which means you can't do anything for that one, can't do anything there. This one's breathing, talking, not bleeding, bad, good, stay right there, I'll be back, and go all the way up the line from person to person just to see if there's who can you help, who can't you help. And the problem with field triage is that you really can't stop and do a lot like CPR, because then the rest of the people don't have anybody looking at them.
Right.
So you just keep moving, and I look back, and my wife was not there. So I'd broken two cardinal rules. Number one, you don't get out of your ambulance, and I was an ambulance driver before I went to medical school. You don't get out of the ambulance when there's reports of shots are fired until the police have cleared the scene. And there were no police.
Mm-hmm.
The second rule was you never, ever leave your wingman.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise taught me that. Top Gun, and I left my wingman. She got swept to the back of the store because she thought it was a chain falling off a truck. So I looked back, and my wife wasn't there, and I kept working, going up the line. Then I looked back a couple, 3 minutes later, and she had sort of pushed past the 17-year-old sacker who was functioning as a security guy, saying, "You can't go out there." She said, "My husband's out there, and I'm leaving. I've got to go out there. I'm a nurse. I can help." Sort of pushed away aside, came outside, and the first person she saw, she turned him over and started doing CPR. So I got to up the line. There's a doctor. It turned out to be a doctor doing CPR on the young girl. He was in the parking lot. The shots rang out, threw his wife back in the car, and ran up to her, going to her first, just because, you know, she was a young girl laying there. And then one of my colleagues, I didn't know it, but I got all the way through the line, and four people were holding down the shooter, and one of them was Dr. Stephen Rail. I didn't recognize him at the time. I could barely even tell the shooter was Caucasian because I could see one arm, and that was about it. So I said, "Okay, hold him. I'll send the first officer over here," and went and started back down, checking on people again, who's still breathing, who's bleeding bad, and making sure patients, victims had somebody with them. And the people that were with them were people who were shot in the leg, holding a hand over a chest wound on the guy or a woman next to them. So here's somebody wounded that isn't screaming, "Medic, medic," they're taking care of the guy next to him who's worse off. So it was one of those chaotic scenes that you try and make some kind of order to by deciding who you can help and who you can't. That was the hardest decision. With this traumatic cardiopulmonary resuscitation has a very, very poor prognosis. It's not like the heart stops and you can shock it. It goes again, as we saw at the scene. So after 15 minutes, the paramedics got there. I felt it was 90 minutes.
Yep.
It could have been 2 hours, as far as I was concerned. They responded quickly, but the police had the scene cordoned off. They can't send rescuers in until they have cleared the scene and it's safe. So you could hear the police got there very quickly, and I met the first officer and sent him to take care of the shooter because he needed to be restrained. More than the four guys sitting on him, although they did a great job. And The second officer I sent to is Congresswoman Giffords, because she was pretty that shape, but was starting to move her left side. So eventually the paramedics got there. I just directed them to the two critical ones, which I felt were the young girl and Giffords, with the that had to get out of there quick. And then we finally had enough paramedic crews that there was a crew with pretty much each victim, at least the ones with the chest wounds, which were the most serious. And after a total of, I looked at it, it was 30 to 35 minutes, we were able to clear the scene and drag my wife away from what she was doing. And it was harder for her and harder for a couple of bystanders, because they're the ones that get right down close with the patient. And they're talking to them. They're telling them to, you know, keep looking at me, tell me how you feel. And that's a very close bond that develops. Field triage, you just have to keep moving.
Yeah.
So for her, and a bystander stepped forward to say, I can help you do CPR if you want, because my wife was doing it on the judge, and relieved her, and she started doing mouth-to-mouth. And I finally had to go over to my wife and pull her off and say, honey, he's gone. I need help with this lady who's been shot in the chest laying in the street. And so she pulled away, and pulling her away, it's pretty hard when they develop that bond. So it was, obviously, as you can tell, pretty traumatic scene. More for others than for me. I'm supposed to be the doc. I can handle all that. Yeah, but they don't teach this course in medical school.
Yeah.
You know, you just happen to be there. You don't teach it in ambulance school either, although I've had some experience doing field triage at major accident scenes. It was nothing as personal as this. So many people all at once. So that's what happened one Saturday morning. You know, without getting into gory details, it was, to me, a matter of trying to stay organized, not losing it emotionally, take care of some of the bystanders who need to be sort of ushered away a little bit, away from the scene. Some people will step right forward and say, can I help you? I know CPR. And other people will stand there and scream. And they just need to have somebody take them away.
Yeah.
It doesn't help anybody to, if you're just standing there making noise. So. And so as it turned out, there were, at the end, look, there was my doc from TMC and a doc doing CPR on the young girl, and the doc holding the guy down, who, once the police officer put him in cuffs, he started working on people on the other end of the line, if you will, and they all sort of aligned it, same as Giffords. And looked around, there's four doctors at Safeway at 10:30 on a wonderful Saturday morning. I said, what are the odds of that? Yeah, pretty slim, you know. I should have been playing golf, personally.
So. Looking back, you know, I've read a little bit about the fight or flight, you know, instinct, and you said that, you know, some people jump right in and want to help, and others, you know, react in a different way. You know, you say that was your first instinct. You know, can you recall from the time, you know, the shots to being able to actually get to the first victim?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when the shots rang out, I was 150% sure they were gunshots. They're not firecrackers. It wasn't a chain falling off a truck. I mean, just, I've heard it before, so, yeah, that helped. But I walked quickly from the produce section out to the scene, which was not probably more than 60, 90 seconds involved. In terms of, they said the shots were all 31 of them, 31, 32 maybe, one in the chamber, were done in 12 seconds. To me, it sounded like 12 seconds he was already reaching for another clip to reload.
Yeah.
The woman grabbed that. So, you know, there was no more shots. And, you know, when I was knelt down with Congresswoman Gifford, somebody was saying, they got the shooter. I said, oh, well, good. I guess maybe I should think about that a little bit. You're just too busy.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it kick in instinctually? You know, it sounds like you were almost attracted to the sound. And by the time you got to the door, it was almost going on autopilot in the, you know, like you said, field triage mode.
No, you're just on automatic. And actually, after I dealt with the first two victims pretty quickly, Giffords taking most time to get her situated, I did stop and look out in the parking lot just to see if anybody was aiming anything at the rest of us. And, well, people were still running and clearing the scene. Nobody was aiming anything, so I said, okay, I guess we're safe if they've got the shooter. And I didn't really know where it was, if they had him, but it was down at the end of the line. I was sort of at the front of the line. So you do, you just go on automatic. I mean, it's, I don't know why, but how do you tell a fireman whether the guys with the yellow coats and the helmets running into a burning building?
Yeah.
You know, how do you tell an off-duty fireman? It's a guy in T-shirt and tennis shoes running into a burning building. So when you're trained to do that stuff, it just becomes automatic. You don't really, I never thought about not going out there. I think my wife called my name and I wasn't in the crowd at the back of the store. She never thought about staying there. It was just, she's an ICU nurse. Gotta get out there.
Yeah.
Now, I was in trouble. What the hell are you doing? Running the gunshots. I said, I didn't run. I'm 61 years old. I walked fast, but I didn't run.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the wife's response. You go on automatic mode. Sort of do what you have to do and do what you're sort of trained to do.
And I'm sure that there's a, you know, it's a moral instinctual, you know, you want to be helpful mode, and I can be even more helpful than just the average Joe because of my training.
Should be able to.
Yeah.
If you can keep it together emotionally, keep your head straight, yeah, you should be able to help. And I think that's, to me, how much help were we? What did we accomplish? And it really took 2 weeks to really say that when all of the victims that had expired were the ones that were dead at the scene, and everybody that got taken away made it out of the hospital, it sort of sunk in, okay, we made the right decisions with the right people at the right time, because nobody else died en route. Nobody died on the operating room table because they didn't pick up their gunshot wound to the back of the chest. They all made it. So if there was any good feeling, it was the fact that, okay, did the right thing today. We all wake up trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And it took 2 weeks to really realize that it looks like we did the right thing today.
Along those same lines, you know, what in your training, you know, obviously nobody's ever prepared for such a, you know, such a situation as, you know, multiple, you know, gunshot wounds. But, you know, in your training as a physician and or even and later in career as an actual hospitalist, what do you think helped you out during this during the time period?
I think keeping your priorities straight in terms of it's airway. Without an airway, people don't live. And then you're looking for bleeding. Is there bleeding? And then, you know, if they're talking, not a lot of bleeding, they have a pulse, that's good enough for right now. Just lady, keep pushing on the chest right there where you're holding that wound. So I think if you remember your ABCs, that's all you can do in a field triage situation. Just remember, you got to make sure people are breathing. And if they aren't, it's because they've been shot in the head, which happened. And there's nothing you can do there. And move to the next person, see if you can help them. One guy had a tourniquet on his leg when I got to him. I think he tourniqueted himself. It's a big pool of blood, but not now. I said, okay, just keep holding it tight. Help is on the way. Even if it did take 120 minutes to get there. I think that it was, you know, just return to the basics and trying to keep yourself organized. Okay, I got to see that one and this one, and then go back and look again. I think hospitalists do this every day at 3 or 4 in the afternoon when the day guy's getting ready to leave the ER. He'll call you and say, I have 6 admissions all at once. He's been working on them for 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't give all 6 to the hospitalist, then you, based on the information given to you, you have to decide, well, who's sickest? Who do I need to get to first? Who's going to the ICU? Who may be going to the ICU? So you do this triage thing in your mind as you're walking, you know, towards the ER.
Yeah.
If there's any corollary, it's the fact that as a hospitalist, you get hit with a slew of sick patients all at once. They don't just come in once every 15 minutes like in your office for a blood pressure check. They don't come in once an hour in the ER and they give you one and you spend an hour and then they give you another one. It's, boom, here they are. Sorry, but, you know, I'm off 30 minutes. And I just know they're going to have to come in because this is what's happening. So there's that ongoing exposure to making those decisions, especially if you're doing night work when you're the only one in the hospital, basically, that, okay, which ones need to be seen first?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a quick glance, and okay, go on to the next one, and talk to the nurse, all right, pulse is okay, blood pressure's coming down, fine, go to the next person and make those decisions quickly on a case-by-case basis. Who needs my attention the most right now?
You say that, you know, Congresswoman Giffords, you know, you had to spend a little bit more time with her because she was, you know, injured in a, you know, in critical areas. You know, and of course she's received the most media attention, but, you know, looking back and from those first few moments when you arrived on the scene, did you ever think that she'd be able to pull through as well as she has?
In truth, when I was first with her, she wasn't responding. She was breathing, although with a compromised airway, got that straight away. She had a good pulse. Daniel Hernandez, the young man with her, who had a check of pulse, had had some nursing training, some medical training, and was comfortable being with her. It was pretty amazing to me the second or third time down the line just to look over at this guy, and he was watching for me, and he would nod and say, we're okay. She's breathing. I didn't have to go back. Pulse is okay. She's breathing. And the third time down, he said, she's moving. She's moving. She's squeezing my hand. And I looked, and she was moving her left arm and was squeezing his hand volitionally. And I thought the kid was going to jump up and say, go, Wildcats, go. I mean, and I have to tell you, that's the first time that I felt, wow, if we can get her out of here quick enough, she's got a chance. But just to see that moving, to see that volitional stuff, rather than just breathing and have a pulse. It was, to me, with the extent of the wound, I was obviously shocked and amazed that she was doing that even at that point, 15 minutes into this. I mean, I'm very hopeful. You don't have to print it, but what I'm going to tell my Republican colleagues that I'm sure she'll make it back to be in their party. Maybe she won't be a Democrat, but she can at least be a Republican. And then I'll get a lot of grief from them, I know, but I don't know how far she'll make it or how long it's going to take, but there are some miracles out there.
Yeah. I know you know there's been a lot of attention about your wife also, you know, with the judge, and you know, she obviously benefited the situation, and I know you said that it was hard for her and others to be pulled away from, you know, those that they were in close contact with. Have the two of you kind of discussed the day, or, you know, kind of gone back and forth or run things through your mind about that day since then, or have you just kind of leave that for a day in the future?
No, continuously. I mean, it's just, you know, one of my paramedic friends called Saturday afternoon when our name went out on the airway and said, you may not need this, Bowman, because you're a doctor, but your wife definitely will. And had the acute event decompression counselor from the University Trauma Center call us. She called us on Sunday and said, look, I'll come up to the house if you like. We said, no, we'll meet you on Monday. So we met her down there, and actually have had two sessions with her just to talk about it. She doesn't record anything. She doesn't write anything down. She's not a Dr. Phil saying, how does this work for you? She just says, tell me what you're thinking. How was it there? She's excellent. She's an ER nurse who then has a bunch of initials after her name, none of them saying doctor or PhD. It's a very common sense approach, and she works with the trauma staff and the paramedics because they see this every day. We had a paramedic helicopter go down here a year and a half ago, and so these people are working on their friends at the trauma center. That's a hard thing to do. Her job is to keep the staff together, you know, prevent the shell shock, if you will. So it was helpful going to that person, and it's helpful we talk with our friends and talk to each other about things to the point where my wife had to pull out a 3x5 card and start making a diagram where people were lying and put a little X through this person and an X through that person. I didn't even want to see that. But for her, that's how she processed it. I have to know, how did these people do? And like I said, for three to four of those patients. She was right there down on the ground with them.
Mm-hmm.
While I kept moving around, checking on people. So we talk about it a lot. She is more of the kind of person who can talk and talk publicly, sort of how she was trained, and I'd rather climb in a gopher hole and lick my wounds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hear hesitation from me or my voice, it's just that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I refused initially to give any interviews. I said, I'm not talking to anybody. On the advice of my boss, he said, it'll be like blood in the water and they're sharks. They'll just keep circling, so you got to tell at least once or twice. So they did.
Was there one patient or victim, and it maybe that stands out that you feel like you maybe did more for than the others, or that you really wanted to make sure of what was going on? I mean, I know that Giffords has got a lot of the attention, but was there anybody else that you may have saw that hadn't been attended to, or anything like that?
Well, there were so many people with gunshot wounds to the chest. It was a matter of getting somebody. Can you put your hand right there? Can you stay right with this person lying face down in the street so that if she does stop breathing or she's conscious? It's mainly just pairing the wounded up with the less wounded or somebody that wasn't wounded. It's hard for me to say that we did any more for one than the next.
I mean, yeah.
We didn't even have rubber gloves. I mean, where's my trauma kit to the ER and all the trained help in the world? They're not there, so. It's hard to say that there's one versus the other. I know the four chest wounds were the ones that were worrisome to me. Nobody really hit the abdomen. All chest wounds and leg wounds, just really from the recoil of his gun.
Mm-hmm.
Could manage it real well, but he hit 19 people. That's not bad.
Yeah.
Out of 32 shots. So I couldn't say. I would say my wife felt that Susie Heilman, who was the woman that brought the little girl to the scene, she felt she probably did more good there because my wife was the one making the phone call on the lady's phone, and she's trying to dial the parents of the child and gave the phone to my wife, said, could you please call him and tell him? So she had to make the phone calls, both their cell phone at home, and leave a message. Because nobody would answer. And then at the end, Susie Heilman says, now can you please call my husband? So all she's doing is laying there worried about the little girl. Can you please call my husband? And so when I tried to pull her out of the scene, when all the paramedics were there, I said, come on, honey. We got to clear the scene. The pros are here. They have the protocols. They got equipment. And she said, no, I have to stay with Susie. I have to stay with Susie. And in terms of that woman being shot three times and somebody holding pressure in the groin where she shot, and my wife putting a hand on her chest wound and holding it and then finding somebody else's hand to hold the chest wound while she made the phone calls. I mean, that was sort of, she probably felt that she did more good there than anywhere else. Certainly with the judge, she couldn't do anything, although they tried a lot.
You've talked about that scene where everybody pitched in, and I think in one article I read that some of the inspiration was watching those people with no medical training just trying to help, or those who were injured trying to help other people who were injured more. Could you just speak? I mean, that's got to be heartwarming to a certain extent.
That, to me, that's the most amazing thing of the whole morning, is that people out of their element, willing to step forward and say, I know CPR, can I help? And my wife and her saying, yeah, please. So, and people who are injured holding somebody's hand in their lap, because they were hitting the leg and this person's hitting the chest. But having people willing to do that, not necessarily family members. There was, one woman holding her husband who died immediately at the scene, but it was just, everybody was so tightly packed in one little area when you see Gabriel Giffords. When you're lying next to somebody and you're both bleeding, but you're not bleeding as bad, just to watch them being willing to be part of the solution now, it was sort of gives you hope for the human race that, wow. To me, those are the heroes, the people out of their element be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the public has a hopes and prays that there are paramedics and nurses and doctors and police officers there to help them at a time like that. In fact, I think they have a right to expect that help from those professionals. But for, you know, for the general bystander layperson just to step forward and say, I took a CPR class once 10 years ago, can I help out? You know, that was to me very moving to have those people there, both victims and bystanders, ready to jump in.
Have you kept in contact or checked up on any of the victims or their families?
No, my wife has. Except for the husband of Susie Heilman, the woman who brought the young girl, who emailed us a couple of times. We met her husband at actually the first interview we gave. And my wife heard his name. She sort of broke down because, Jesus, I called you. And so, of course, there were the tears and hugs and things with them. And they've stayed in touch. We went to the memorial service. My wife, she walks in. She was not with me. I was with a group from the hospital. They wanted me to go with them. And the husband sees my wife, says, Nancy, come over here. And he had a front row center seat. He said, this is my daughter. Please sit here with us. I need your help. So she got very close with him. To the point the last email was the victim saying, you know, when I'm up and around better, we're all going to go to dinner. We may not laugh much, but we need to be together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how Nancy processes things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when you're the field triage guy, you just sort of keep moving.
Gotcha. Well, you know, that kind of, you've told the national media, you know, that you don't consider yourself a hero, and that, you know, many of the lay people there were just as much heroes in your mind. You know, what do you consider a hero, and or, you know, what looking back, you know, how would your role be described?
A hero is somebody, to me, that steps out of their element, steps up to the task that's needed, that is completely foreign to them, and is unable to perform and help somebody. That's a hero.
Mm-hmm.
A hero is not somebody who should be able to help in some manner and should be expected to help in some manner. So I don't think the paramedics, nurses, doctors, firemen get to be labeled as heroes. We don't wear that moniker. It's sort of what we should do and gladly do. And many times took an oath, either personally or in public, to do. So I think the heroes are the people who step out of their element and are able to rise up to a very, very challenging occasion.
Okay.
That's the heroes.
All right. I just have a couple more questions.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is really more of a professional question in that I noticed in going through some of the reports that everybody, all of the media referred to you as a doctor or a physician and never really reported you as a hospitalist. And just wondering, did you tell people you were a hospitalist and they just translated that as a physician, or do you think that they're just not familiar yet enough with what a hospitalist is?
That's a great question. Obviously, the scene when you kneel down, hi, I'm a doc. I'm a doctor, can you tell me what's going on? Can you talk to me? It goes no farther than that. It's sort of some comfort with one of the victims who said, well, my legs hurt, but I don't think he made it. He got it right in the temple. It's a clean gunshot wound to the temple, and she's laying in his lap. And so I said, well, keep talking to him. He might be able to hear you. I just couldn't tell her, but she knew. So when she started up, she says, it's okay, honey, help is here. Oh, great. Great help. Don't even have rubber gloves. But, you know. So at the scene, you're a doctor. And after a while, I didn't even probably say that each time. But in talking with one of the interviewers, she says, well, what kind of doctor are you? And I said, well, I'm an internist, and now I'm a hospitalist, which which is a doctor who works just in the hospital. And they weren't interested in that, because when she cameras rolled, I understand you're an intern. I said, no. Turn it off and start again. I'm an internist. So that's the level of knowledge you're dealing with. And this is a national anchor person that is saying this. So the hospitalist thing never really gained any traction, never came up. Doctor was as far as it got, doctor and nurse. I certainly can understand that. You explain who a hospitalist is every day, and we've been doing it now for 12, 13, 14 years, pretty heavily, but people still don't really understand.
Sure.
That wasn't frustrating for me. It was just, okay, that's the way it is. Okay, if people understand what a doctor is, but a hospitalist, they sort of look at you funny, because it's not how we do things in America yet. In Europe, they've been doing it this way for 50 years.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, we're finally catching up to the rest of the world, my German doctor tells me. You're right.
Good, thanks. And really, the only other question, and then I was just going to give you some time if you wanted to say anything else, but, you know, just looking ahead, or, you know, speaking to hospitalists, you know, colleagues, peers in the profession, you know, just any words of advice or anything like that, in that, you know, now a lot of hospitalists get I don't know exactly what I wanted to say there. You know, you said that you resorted back to your training, the ABCs, the prioritization, but those are all things that doctors do hospitalists do on a regular basis. Yet when you're thrown into this situation, you know, you got to be able to recall some of the stuff you haven't done in a while. I guess that's kind of more just what
If I had any advice for them, is it be ready. And by the way, you are ready. You're a hospitalist, you're a generalist. You take care of a stroke patient in room one, and you're taking care of a gangrenous leg in room two, and you've got a diabetic with ketoacidosis in room three. So with the broadness, the generality of your training, you are ready to take care of a variety of things. And whether it's a gunshot wound to the groin, or a head wound, or a chest wound, you're going to have the skills at some point in time, at least talking about if not doing them, that you're going to be able to help, but you got to be ready. Doctors like the off-duty firemen, you're never off-duty. Just be ready.
Okay.
And whether it's an automobile accident or, you know, shoot them up at the local bar that you happen to drive into.
And chemical explosion, or
chemical explosion. Yeah. It's, you know, it's all around us, and you just got to be ready and use the skills that over 5, 10, 20 years you've gained to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem.